Hey, welcome back to another episode of Convince Me, brought to you by NPR Illinois and the Front Row Network. I'm your host, Larry Smith, and have we got an awesome one for you today. Oh boy, I am excited. Got the opportunity to sit down and talk to my buddy, Kevin Kautzman, who is a playwright, and he has a new play that is just dropped or released, or whatever your classy people say, but it is just released as a podcast, and it is called Moderation. And we get into Kevin's accomplishments and such. He's won fellowships. He was an international student play, the UK international student play script. He's going to listen to this and laugh at me fumbling over this. But anyway, check out Moderation. We tell you how to find it. But I was really thrilled to get to talk to him. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this very special episode of Convince Me with Kevin Kautzman. Thanks for listening, guys.
Hello.
How are you, sir?
I am well. How are you?
I'm dandy. Thanks for joining me today.
Okay. All right. Candy is dandy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's my standard answer.
Right.
It, when I worked retail 20 years ago, anytime someone would walk up and ask one of the dudes that I worked with, be like, "How you doing?" And he'd always go, "Dandy." And it was so loaded. And,
uh-huh. Yeah.
But
I think of Oscar Wilde coming to the United States with his little flower in his lapel and his fancy boy clothes.
Yes.
He went so hard that people had to accept him.
Yes.
Confrontational.
Absolutely.
Yeah. This is the podcast where we get on Twitch and play Tetris together.
Yes.
Is that the one?
Yeah, this is you have to convince me to use the long piece early. That's the whole point of this.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So thanks Tetris for
go on.
Let me just go ahead and load it, and we'll get right onto Tetris, and then later we'll do some Mega Man, which I've noticed that you are playing quite a bit of this week.
I just queued up Mega Man 3. I'm going through them methodically, cheating all the while, of course.
Yeah.
You know, using the emulator to save at the critical points. Basically, slowly correcting my troubled childhood with the emulator that I have here.
Excellent, excellent. If we can go back and fix some of our mistakes, I think that's perfect.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting. I still have some sort of ancestral memory, tribal memory of which bosses to attack in which order. It's just ingrained, deeply embedded inside my genetic code. It's like if my newborn son picks up Mega Man, I think he's gonna instinctively know that first you go to Cut Man and then you go to Wood Man and then you there's an order to these things.
Absolutely.
It's kind of like, yeah, it's like nerd Kabbalah.
I have no follow up to that because that's a perfect line. I don't mind being being outdone with words, especially by someone who does it, you know, so beautifully as you do. So,
That's very kind.
I'll leave it there. So, as if you listen to the intro, if you didn't fast forward through it, today I'm talking with my friend, Kevin Kautzman, and he is a screenwriter and brilliant playwright. You're just going to have to get used to me being effusive with praise on my podcast, because if I have somebody on, I'm obviously a fan of them. So I want to talk to you a little bit, because like I told you, this is just me introducing you to new friends.
And
all of my listeners know that each one of them that downloads are my friend. And I appreciate them.
Okay, that's good. That's very nice. Getting warm. Yeah, it's hard to make friends right now in 2020. It's a tough year for friendship.
For sure. Well, and I was always a big one for, you know, online is, those are acquaintances. And,
right.
You know, we're all just doing what we can. And now in 2020, starting in March, I'm like, these are all my friends because this is the only way I can see other human beings.
Without a doubt. And, you know, what we're going to talk about here today, this podcast that we're doing for Moderation for my new play, partly came out of that connection I made on Twitter, just like we met on Twitter.
Yeah.
And I am beginning to notice that people are changing their expectations from these things. I mean, we're on Skype right now. We're seeing each other, and it's like, this is it. This is the surrogacy for what would be a normal connection you'd make maybe down at a bar or if you do a sport or whatnot. The one in real life friend that I made this year came from an archery class that I took. And I made kind of a hunting buddy. He's a PhD. He's getting his PhD in conservation. But who's going to take up archery in their 30s? You know, it's a real particular person who does that. So anyway, yeah, I'm glad. I'm glad that you're treating it that way. I treat everybody I meet online as a potential CIA handler.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't know. It could be you.
I'll be honest. I'm just waiting for someone to whisper the word that mm-hmm. releases me. And it's got, I hear a lot of words, so it's got to be something completely outlandish that mm-hmm. I would never have come across in my 42 years that somebody's just going to come up and whisper, you know, like, I can't even think.
I'm going to say the phrase nerd Kabbalah 3 times on this podcast. That's and on two. The third time, you're going to be triggered. Right. So just wait for it.
That's I knew it. I knew it.
Typical playwright. I've got to put the bomb under the table, right?
Oh, no one with such a good speaking voice can be completely benign. I knew it.
That is true. Yeah, there is a certain kind of evil that comes along with this radio voice, including the face that's the cliche face for radio, right? It's too much power. One man should not have this much power.
It's true. It's true.
To quote the great presidential candidate, Kanye West.
No, yes, the greatest presidential candidate of our time.
I'm in Minnesota, and I saw him on the ballot, and I had a little moment. I was like, okay, this is real.
Yeah.
This is real. Was he on the ballot in Illinois?
I am going on the day of.
Okay.
Our polling place is very small, so and by that I mean it just covers our little – okay, so we live in Springfield, but we actually live in a village inside of Springfield. So they were neighboring and Springfield grew around this little village called Jerome. And so we've never incorporated with Springfield. So our polling place is the small community center and you're in and out even on a busy day, you're in and out in at most 10 minutes.
Oh, great. Yeah. So doing it locally makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And we had talked about doing mail-in and doing early voting, and we were like, you know what, we get the day off anyway,
right?
We will let's just do 3 shots of bourbon in the morning, walk up to the polling place, you know, put our ballots in, walk back home, do some more shots, and then take a nap. And that's like I described on Twitter, this electoral season is just watching my dog and the neighbor's dog run to the fence, bark at each other, turn their backs, take a tandem deuce, and then walk away like they've actually accomplished something.
That's an excellent metaphor. That's very much what it is.
Well, you know, you're not the only one with pretty words, Kevin. I'll be
honest. Oh, no, yeah. Funny guy. Very funny dude.
So I want to talk about moderation because you sent me the link and I listened to it on Friday. And of course, I made it through Act 2 and thanked you for the 43 minute anxiety attack. Which, and I say that with all love and respect for the work, because it did to me exactly what it was supposed to do. It was like uncut gems without the pretense. It was, I had the same visceral reaction of, I need to take a breath and a break before I finish this. And
great.
And so I know you mentioned a little bit about how this came about, but give me a little bit more. When did you start working on this? Was this just at the beginning of the pandemic, or did you have this idea before that?
Yeah, so I first drafted the play in 2019, in the summer of 2019. And I had had the idea for the play for a number of years. And in a funny way, the zeitgeist finally kind of began to catch up with it. And there are some great media stories, some great stories online. If you do a search for social media content moderators, PTSD, for example, you'll find some really intense stuff. The Verge did a piece on it. Recently, Facebook settled a lawsuit to the tune of $52 million with these poor content moderators who've been subjected to what in the past would have been called almost like MK Ultra level experimentation on their brains without any real proper support. And of course, it's not Facebook employing them directly, because Facebook has this kind of BS canard where their median salary is $250,000, right? That's one of their things. Sure. Of course, they hire contractors who then hire these very, very junior people to essentially be the, and I mean no disrespect to garbage men here, but to be the garbage men of the internet, of social media, and to watch, to basically pick through the detritus and the trash and to find the bodies and all the rest. Pretty horrific stuff. So as a writer, I'm not one of these playwrights who takes my marching orders from the media. You know, I don't want to talk out of school, but you can sort of see how people are, you know, reading the New York Times and listening to NPR and whatnot and going, oh, that'd make a good play. And then it appears as a play. That's not the case here. It wasn't like, oh, I heard this story and then I decided I've got to turn it into a play. It was more like everything was kind of coalescing all at once. I'd wanted to write this for a long time. I've been in tech personally for a good long while. I run a small digital agency. We have the Firefighters Union as a client. We do WordPress websites, open source. So I come from this kind of open source ethos, and I was kind of reared on the internet. I was that first generation of people who were given AOL disks, and then AOL went big time, you know, went and opened the internet, and then our brains were completely fried and changed forever. But I remember when the internet was a bit more of you know, the Wild West, and it has become, and it's a real shame to watch these walled gardens grow up, Twitter, Facebook, etc. There's a lot going on right now around censorship and all the rest. Long story short, you know, I started writing the play last summer. I drafted it. I've had so much wonderful help from a variety of people. We had a couple of table readings in New York City. A buddy of mine in London organized a little table reading, private, all private. Then this group I'm a part of called Cut Edge Collective, which is this experimental theater writing collective that I co-founded. We did a workshop there. Then this theater company in D.C. called Spooky Action Theater, named after the I think it's like an it's like a quantum physics kind of thing. The quanta do spooky actions, right? It's called Spooky Action Theater. They did a Zoom reading of it during pandemic. So that was very interesting, because this play is, you know, two content moderators at their desks at work. And there's this kind of device, quite literally in the play, that's similar to Beckett's dumbwaiter. Mm-hmm. Or not Beckett, Pinter, excuse me, Pinter's dumbwaiter, where you know, their computers are delivering new things into the scene, and then they're kind of describing them. So it was really, really funny to hear this read on Zoom, of course, because it's a play that lends itself to that. Now, I met a fellow on Twitter who's a young or a burgeoning, a baby producer. He wants to make stuff. His name's Jeff Giese. So Jeff reached out and said, hey, do you have any, you know, do you want any money for art stuff, for theater stuff? I'm like, yes. You know, like what? Like what? Like, you know, it's 2020 and I'm like a working American playwright. We're an endangered species right now. Everybody's flapping around, has no idea what to do. So of course I said yes, you know, got to know him a bit. And I sent him moderation, sent him that Zoom reading, and he said, this is awesome. Let's turn this into a something. And we just landed on the idea that we would take the amazing reading that the Spooky Action people put together. Very talented people. If you go to moderationplay.com, it's coming out this Tuesday. So it's coming out Tuesday, October 27th. It's going to be three acts and then a talk back. Moderationplay.com. All the names of the talent are there. Some very, very talented people did that reading. And we just reached out to them and said, hey, can we turn this into like a radio play type thing? And we worked with a company called Resonate Recordings. They do this. And boom, here we are. We've got kind of this hacker mentality. Like, let's get something out there. This is timely. Let's do it. And so here we are.
That's perfect. You pretty much covered every question I would have had. So that was awesome. And again, as somebody that I felt so privileged when you sent me those links. And I did just immediately was like, I'm listening to this. And I kept... you know, we're my wife and I are both working from home. She's working across the room, and I just kept stopping and looking at her. And I'm like, I am not going to let you listen to this. I want you to download it so that they get the hits. And I just so you know, I went ahead and subscribed.
Oh, yeah. Go. Great. Yeah. Fantastic. Please go subscribe. And if you like it, give it 5 stars. This is very punk, very guerrilla stuff here. We're not. It's yeah.
It's brilliant. Yeah. And that's the other thing that got me as it, you know, as somebody who as a comic, I'm all about doing good one night shows and cool venues as opposed to multiple mediocre shows in a standard comedy club. This touched on that Generation X, fine, we'll just do it however we do it. And
yeah,
that's it. Screw the rest of you. And I really, I dug that about it, but I mean, just, there was no, and I want to talk about other stuff, but I could, cause I could do a whole episode just on this play. And I also don't want to give a lot of it away, but there was no, fat on the words, Kevin. Mm. You had everything, every word was precise, every scene meant something, and there were even moments that after I finished the listening to it, there were moments that I thought initially, I'm like, oh, this was a nice little sidebar on it, but everything plugged into everything else. And it was, there was no fluff. It was just all really solid writing, and your voice talent.
Yeah, they're great.
They were great. Now, as somebody who had been in theater for years, I'll be honest, I'm listening to the mail. That's the other thing. I thought it was really cool. There were no names. But I kept listening to the mail, and I'm going, I mean, that was a good choice, but I would have done it differently. As
right.
You know, as every douchebag actor ever does.
Yeah, everybody's a critic.
No, that was very good. I could see why he would do that, but as I think I would do that differently.
And may I say, I think that's a sign that there's something there, that the play has legs, because you know, you could imagine 10 different versions of this play with 10 different meanings.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe one day you'll do it.
Honestly, it would be something I would love to do, because it's so it's just so good. Everybody who's listening, go subscribe to this podcast and listen to it and leave reviews, because it's genius. And that's, you know what, let's just end the interview. That's the best it's going to get.
No, that's amazing. Keep it coming. I'm a Leo. I'm very, and I haven't had the sort of primping and the attention that I deserve this year.
Boy, I get that.
And my newborn son was born on my birthday. So he stole my birthday's thunder. It's brutal.
Oh man, yeah. You've had a rough year.
Yeah, it was really rough. Yeah. No, he's a little gift. He's just so cute.
He is.
Yeah.
He's adorable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just seeing your kids on social media, I look, and you know, I've got 3 kids of my own, but I look at your younger kids and I go, we could have a baby. And then, you get reminded of the fact that you actually have to raise them. And I'm like, man, I could borrow a baby every once in a while. Just,
yeah, there are a lot of people right now who are pretty happy being the wine aunts or the, you know, the truck uncles who show up for football games. And that's cool.
Yeah.
Babies are pretty mimetic though. You see a baby and you're of a certain age. There's a thing, you know, babies kind of go viral, right? There's like, I kind of want one of my own. But yeah, once you've done it, you know how many calories it burns to to see them come of age. It's not easy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. I've got, you know, all teenagers, and that's a task unto itself. And so the moments, like one of their, you know, the pictures of them when they're little, and as I put it, my ovaries start to hurt, and and then one of them will come in and say, or you know, admit to something or just do something, and I'm like, Right. We're nearly done. You're almost out of the house. That's so glad. So yeah. glad, as my wife put it, she didn't have the highways removed. Or the destination wasn't removed. She just blew up the highway to get there.
Wow.
Yeah.
that's quite a, yeah. You're a family that traffics in metaphor.
Yeah, we do. We do. Because it's, you know, why not have fun with the language? I do want to talk a little bit more about some of your other plays. So how many plays have you written that have been published?
I've had one play really properly published. It received a premiere at the Finborough Theatre in London. It's called Dream of Perfect Sleep. It was my MFA play at UT Austin. It did okay. It had a Guardian review, which was very cool to be from a two stoplight town in North Dakota to end up in London. You know, reviewed by the Guardian was very, very cool. That's a play about family and sort of a right to die argument, with a bit of a mytho-poetic twist. I'm very proud of that play. That's published by Oberon. It's available, if you go to Amazon and you look up Dream of Perfect Sleep, you can find that. I wrote a play.
I can confirm that, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. I wrote a play, and you can go to my website. It's kevinkautzman.com. It's kautzman.com. You can get to it from moderationplay.com. And I wrote a play at graduate school at Texas called a Very Stagehand Christmas Reindeer Apocalypse Storm, which is about a bunch of stagehands who take over the holiday Christmas production at their high school and end up staging something that's like this post-apocalyptic thing, and the stagehand who takes over becomes a tyrant, and then it finally, the big turn is that he hasn't actually written this dark drama. It's actually a comedy, and everybody loves him, and it's funny, you know. And that's been done around the country, you know, I think almost a dozen times. And every year I get these nice little notices like, oh, somebody bought the book. And oh, somebody's doing the play. You know, I never hear from any of these people. I think they probably look at my Twitter for 5 minutes like, we'll just leave this guy. You know, somebody recently called my Twitter feed heterodox. And I quite like that. I thought I respected that. I'm definitely not hammering at one thing. You know, I'm not trying to sell you, patchouli oil or whatever. I'm definitely myself, yeah, kind of a freewheeling spirit on there. But I've written a number of others. I've had productions, here and there, and, New York, Dallas, London. But this is a new thing because it's a very strange little play, and I feel like its time is the right play for the time. So it's very interesting to see something that was really never meant to be the representation of the play is going to kind of become the representation of the play for a lot of people. Now, of course, my hope and my dream is that it sees that world premiere in London or in New York City, just the same way that every playwright hopes, mm-hmm. For. And I think eventually it will get that. I mean, it is meant to be on the stage. I didn't write it as a podcast. I didn't, but it lends itself to that. So the timing is fortunate.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And sometimes that just how everything happens and all the puzzle pieces fit together. And yeah. I'm glad that somebody grabbed that and said, "Hey, I've got an idea," and ran with it, because this moderation is not something that should be just sitting and waiting right now. It should be out there and in my review, I can't remember. I wish I had looked it up before.
Where did you review it? Did you review it on iTunes?
Yeah, on iTunes.
Oh, okay, cool. I bet we could find it. Oh, yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, we're definitely hoping to get those reviews. This is a thing that we want to kind of take its own life. We like to say it's a meme. The play itself is a meme. I did a lot of very dark research, very engaged research with some alt accounts to get this play done. I had one on Twitter. Now I'm not allowed to make second accounts on Twitter anymore after researching this play. If you're an anon with any footprint, even if you're doing research for a play and you end up in the UK or in other countries that don't have the freedom of speech laws, maybe shut that account down until you come back to the United States. That's my advice. I got shut down very, very quickly because I was over in London for a thing, and I was still using the account for my research, and like that, was brought down.
Wow.
Something was going on, and I was poking away trying to find something, and they shut it down immediately.
Yikes. That's wow. I didn't, you know, and I take for granted what we get, you know, here. Even I would never even dream that just doing research, even if it is dark research, that would get you, you know, popped like that.
I you know, it's really, really interesting. Do you know the play? And this maybe dovetails into the thing that I love, which is theater, of course, right? And
right.
I say that not in a self-serving way. I mean, I am kind of pitching my play and everything, but at the same time, I really, really do love theater. I'm very, very passionate about it, but I'm also acutely aware of the reputation that it has, and deservedly. There's really nothing greater than a wonderful night in the theater, and nothing worse than a bad night in the theater. And the unfortunate thing about the bad nights is that you know in 5 minutes, very often you know before you even sit that you're in for it. And it's excruciating. And everybody knows exactly what I'm talking about. And I've been a part of it. I've been a part of creating theater like that. And I also think I've been a part of the other side of it. And it requires such an indulgence. I was laying awake last night thinking about this interview in theater and all the rest, and or this podcast we're doing. And the comparison I had is like, you hear a senior band at a very, very good high school that is just famous for their jazz, and you hear their first tier jazz band, and it's just this just bopping, you know, swinging, cool, brassy, awesome thing. If you could just reverse it to the first notes in sixth grade when the trumpeters first get their trumpets, that's the thing in theater. And sometimes you end up listening to that sixth grade recital.
Uh-huh.
And it goes on for 2 hours. You're in a production of Peer Gynt that somebody's done. The translation is horrible. They don't know their – I mean, it's – you can be – and you're looking at your watch, and there's not enough – I mean, what did – and I'm sober right now, but what did Beckett say? He said theater without beer is a museum.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's not Beckett. That was – oh, God, Brecht said that. Yeah. I'm kidding. You know, everything is Beckett tonight.
Yeah, I'm no. You know what? And that's fine. Everything should be Beckett.
Wrecked. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah. But I love theater. So do you know, this is a long way to ask a question of you, do you know the play The Pillow Man?
Yes.
Yeah.
It is. It's a show that my wife and I have always wanted to produce. She's wanted to direct it. And it's the bad cop is a character that my friend played. My friend Jeff played up in Chicago, and watching it, I was like, that's the character I want to play. Because, of course, well, I don't want to give it away. As much as I make this a conversation, I sometimes forget that I'm actually recording a podcast and other people maybe shouldn't be told what the end of a play is.
Sure, right. Yeah, no spoilers.
But yeah, I love The Pillow Man.
It's so good, so dark.
And necessarily dark, because there's some stuff that sometimes you watch it and you're like, what, that choice was bad, and you should feel bad for just trying to make this dark, and Pillow Man was dark in all the right ways.
Absolutely. And of course, it's a play about a writer, and that can be a red flag, but in this case, of course, it's not. And I was just thinking about The Pillow Man in the context of what it's like to be a working writer right now, and of course Google is tracking every last thing we do. Almost certainly they know that we're on Skype right now. If they don't know now, they will eventually, and everything's being tracked. And so you're doing this research. You know, I wrote a play about white supremacists on the border called Coyote. I wrote it in 2008. Coyote. It was called Coyote. And of course, now Twitter this week, Coyote is a big thing because these people don't know that that's what it's called. And they're looking for any reason to pounce on the president. Fine. But my God, you know, if you're a corporate lawyer or a journalist, you can at least, you know, do a quick search. What is he talking about there?
Right.
Unbelievable. Everybody's got their phone right there. Before you tweet, maybe look up what the word means. I wrote that in 2008 and, rewrote it in 2018, and that's never really had a life, the new version of it, but it had a production in Dallas, great little theater company there. It's, I think, now retired, but, but to research that play, I was on Google, and I was on YouTube, and I was looking up some things that would probably get you in trouble, yeah. right? That, and my algorithm, it was very, very interesting to begin to do that research. Legitimately, I'm researching this play. What is this? What are these people thinking? And then my algorithm started feeding me David Duke. And then once you get David Duke, you're down this awful rabbit hole. And I realized, my God, and this was back in the day on YouTube. This is back before anything. And I realized, wow, this is, I'm not the only one looking at this stuff, but I'm looking at it, not ironically, but I guess I'm looking at it as a writer.
Right.
So now what does Google think of me and all the rest? And then I realized, okay, I'm going to start using incognito windows and the rest. But I mean, my gosh, and ditto with Twitter. I have no idea what they think of me. They must think I'm a lunatic. And it's like, no, I'm a creative writer. I'm a professional creative writer. And I apologize if I made you uncomfortable, but there's a certain amount of liberty we need here in order to actually do the work. And I am quite proud because Jeff knows some people who are sort of in, you know, connected on the internet. And he asked a few of them, you know, to look at the play, and the response was, wow, this guy really did his research.
Nice.
And I'm very proud of that. So yeah, weird. I think as writers, I kind of hold it in my pocket, like, oh, I'm a writer. That's my out. Like when they boom, 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 when they come knocking on the door, I'm going to say I'm a writer, but you
know. Please don't. No, yeah, look, right. I get it. I was writing a joke and I'm still working on this bit, and it's a bit that I keep coming back to and then I walk away from, but it was something that I was doing actual research on. And it's why furries are better than the KKK.
Oh man. All right.
And
wow, you're really going at it. That's yeah, there's a lot of, okay.
Yeah. And
sell
so
me.
I understand when you talk about the algorithm being a little messed up. Because for a while, especially on Twitter, I was getting a lot of furry followers, which,
oh boy,
that's fine. Look, man,
hey.
I'm not kink shaming. I just kink question. That's all.
Right.
That is, I'm not yucking anyone's
the
yum.
Old KQ.
Yeah.
You got to do it. Yeah. Sometimes you got to KQ.
Yeah. You got to KQ a little bit. I don't yuck yums, you know, as long as you're not, as long as you're not hurting anyone that doesn't want you to hurt them.
Absolutely. Oh, man. My mind is, I'm just having flashbacks to certain things.
Yeah, we should have established a safe word for this podcast.
I think we did, and I'm going to say it the third time at the end.
Oh, no.
Yeah, no, do what thou wilt, shall be the whole of the law, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
But the mixture of furry material, we'll put it that way, and and also the some alt-right and beyond alt-right and alt-alt-alt-alt-right
alt-wrong
that was popping up, and I'm like, what? Again, somebody on Twitter and somebody at Google is just looking at this going, what is he self-hating? Is he just trying to make a decision? Because when you look at this,
yeah,
it could go either way. I understand.
That is true. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah. Yeah. When you're right, you're right. I mean, it could be a yes and thing too. And then maybe they're sitting in San Francisco going, boy, we got to shut this guy down.
Yeah, we got to.
This gets out of hand.
Oh, boy.
I was listening to a podcast recently. I can't recall which one it is, but it was one of these sort of, it's like a philosophical podcast, and somebody was talking about YouTube, and there was apparently a YouTube insider who was saying they don't think of that website, that platform, in terms of verticals, right? The way that like a business might think of a certain line as a vertical, right?
Okay.
They think of it more holistically and more like a network. But he said if we were to think about it in terms of verticals, like crazy right-wing conspiracy theories would be one of their biggest channels. And I think everybody knows that. And I think anybody who's spent a minute on YouTube knows if you click on that third video, you're instantly into like Q territory.
Yep.
And these stories and my play, I guess, trades some in this world of conspiracies. In fact, this was the thing that really triggered me to finally sit and write Moderation was the story that in one of these articles, I think it was the Verge article, And just to be clear, I don't read these articles word for word 10 times before I sit and write the play, because I don't really want to poison the well too much.
Right.
I kind of get the gist. But that's a very fine article. I would encourage everyone to go and read it, and whoever wrote it, kudos. But it's the thing that really turned me and made me go, this is the play, was when these blue check media orgs, including I think The Verge, but some others, started to pick up this story in their kind of fainting couch way, began to say, oh no, these content moderators are starting to believe the conspiracy theories they're moderating. And I thought, that's a play.
Yep.
That's a play. So you've got Zuck and company and Google and company all posing in one way. And then under the surface, under the floorboards, you know, the redheaded stepchildren in the attic or in the cellar are being radicalized to question the official 9/11 narrative, Building 7, all the rest of it. And that to me is just delicious.
Yeah.
I love that. This is like, it's like a folktale. It's like a modern day folktale.
Yeah, it is. I absolutely agree. And I did not come to that. I didn't come to that conclusion all on my own. I'd like to say I was smart enough to do that. But when, as soon as you mentioned it, I was like, oh yeah, that's totally see that. Totally see that. So I want to get over to this other side, which we'll weave back over as you and I tend to do in our conversations. 'Cause if you haven't, check out Kevin's podcast, Get This. He has a great guest on there, a brilliant comedian and a handsome man.
Right, in his fursuit.
Yes, in my what that was, my beard was longer. It just it looked that way. But
the lawsuit is still pending. It's at getthispodcast.com, and that's a podcast about things people love. So it's a kind of a benign, unironic, earnest podcast where I interview people for an hour about things they love. And it's an excuse for me to chat with cool people and make connections, and I really enjoy doing it.
Yeah. And when you and I connected on Twitter and you were like, hey, be on the show and this is what we do, I was like, oh, that's a lot like my podcast, except that we also talk about things that we hate, because it's fun to talk about stuff you love, and that's why I like to end on the love, but it's also fun to kind of talk about stuff you hate, and and I know I we had discussed a little bit before, you know, today, what you were going to bring up, and normally I call this show Convince Me, because like I've told you before, my first guest and a friend of mine convinced me, or was trying to convince me, that Limp Bizkit was underrated, and the Lord of the Rings movies were overrated.
Oh.
And I'll be honest, by the end of the show, he did remind me that I did 20 years ago have an appreciation for Frederick Durst and the Bizkits. So,
okay. All right.
So, but you're not going to have to convince me too hard, but what is it? Let's talk about your hatred of, go ahead.
Awards shows.
Yes.
Hate them. Despise them. And the fact that people have these, I think somewhat ironic, but maybe not, watch parties for these things, absolutely sickens me. I think Gervais is incredible, and I think he should host them all henceforth. But you know, since the recession and the housing crisis and all the rest that happened now over a decade ago, the idea of sitting to watch the Oscars in an unironic way and the congratulatory slappy hand, happy clappy, rich elitist garbage to me just is, it's beneath contempt. I mean, it's absolutely outrageous. I think it's ridiculous. I mean, that year, the degree, and of course I'm just winning hearts and minds here in Hollywood, I'm sure. But it's, and we all know it, it's just absurd. And it's like this, you've got somebody who's like, I have a tent city outside my window here in St. Paul, Minnesota. And there are tent cities all around the country. And the amount of lip service and just utter BS, and then we're supposed to have this night where it still has this vestige of kind of like an old Hollywood classy kind of a thing. And then, of course, if you drive around L.A., it's beginning to look like Fallout 3.
Yeah.
And everyone knows this, but we're supposed to just still consider these people to be so glamorous, and it's almost like you expect Dean Martin to walk out with a martini. It's like it hasn't moved on. Everything's sparkly and glittery, and then they have their obituaries for their people. It's just yes. So,
but I think they're losing popularity because obviously the Oscars, the ratings kept dropping and dropping, and they kept going, how do we get people interested in it? And younger people are like, we're not interested in this, because, you know, I asked my kids, again, I love having my own Generation Z focus group that lives in my house.
Yeah.
It's fan-friggin-tastic.
Amazing. Yeah.
But I'm like, do you guys want to watch the Oscars or anything? They're like, why?
Yeah.
Who cares? And I was
right.
Like, oh, that makes sense. Who does care? For whatever reason, when I was younger, I liked watching the Oscars, but it was also because, as a kid, I wanted to grow up, be a stand-up comic, actor, writer, and that was the, hey, this is where you come to have your peers tell you how great you are, and congratulations, sure. And the older I've gotten, now I'm just like, I don't care to watch this. We've recorded it every year, and then look at it and go, why do we want to?
I love Martin Scorsese. I love his films, but just the fawning, pandering, cutting to him constantly. Everybody has to. It's this is a group of people who publicly pretend to be the most democratic and left leaning group of people, but they operate like some sort of a feudal monarchy, or like a hierarchy of oligarchs, and it's very feudal. And so just that contrast and the kind of like class tension and everything, I'll watch clips and things that I got invested. You know, I wanted to see Joaquin win for Joker, etc. I'm not saying I don't watch it. I guess I'm saying I hate watch it. And I kind of, and it's not, this isn't sour grapes. This isn't like, oh, I'm an outsider. It's like, no, it's just objectively awful. And it's just, and as the world gets worse and worse and worse outside our doors, the fakery and the BS online and all our biggest, best brains are like, how do we get to Mars? How do we get people more addicted to these social networks? How do we get people to do anything but engage with the world outside their door, which is falling apart? And that, to me, is the story of our generation. And I'm no better, you know. I'm all about online and whatever. So this isn't like I'm not wagging the finger. It's just really conspicuous to me. And there's got to be a way that they can get these award ceremonies back. Look, I wonder. There, you know, it would be fascinating to see. I bet there are award ceremonies for like gamers and streaming that probably get bigger numbers than the Oscars already.
I'm pretty sure that.
Yeah.
Oh God! Now we sound like two old men screaming at clouds, don't we? Well, I think there's the.
You know what really grinds my gears?
You know what I hate?
this is your format, man.
Yeah, I love it. But okay, so we just got done lambasting the Oscars. Let's just throw the Emmys in there too, because those have always been. It's like the Emmys are just the great value Oscars. You know, that's
they're the Costco Oscars.
Exactly. Exactly.
You say that, but it's if you're a TV writer, like, so of course one day if somebody knocked on my door and said, "Hey Kevin, I heard Moderation. We know you're a bit of a prickly personality, but come and write for our show. It's going to be like Black Mirror, but it's going to be this and that." I'm not going to say no to getting staffed on a TV show, and of course I would endeavor to be a team player, etc. I'd be a good writer. I think it'd be an asset. And if you could get nominated for an Emmy or win an Emmy for writing a show, you're made. Yeah. So that stuff really matters. What they show too, it's like if you were to watch the Oscars or the Emmys, you would think that it's all actors, it's all maybe the director, and it's like there is this whole strata of stuff going on in and around, we can't even say Hollywood anymore, I suppose film and television production, that is goes totally unseen, and those things matter. Like an Emmy nod means you might get to be a showrunner on your own show, etc. So, you know, I'm talking more about the veneer and sort of the gushy kind of
sure.
It's so, the way they do those things is so it's dinosaur media.
Yeah. No, yeah. Absolutely. It's a holdover from, like you said, the old Hollywood glitz and glamour that was, I mean, it was there because we were a struggling nation that just needed escapism.
Mm.
But I think the problem is we've escaped for too long.
Oh, yeah.
Now it's time to, you know, we just kept slapping, new siding on a house that's crumbling.
The yard is on fire.
Yeah, it's crumbling. The yard's on fire and the the infrastructure is being eaten by termites.
Yeah, right.
But if we put new siding on.
Yeah, and our cousins are sleeping in tents out the back.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. It's a real mess. I mean, the thing that I think I sometimes say is like, we our best people, and by which I mean, our best people look down at their phones in 2012 and are just starting to look up again now.
Yeah,
and that's a serious problem.
Yeah,
that we have.
I would like to go back to something.
Yeah, sure.
Let's go. That you mentioned, and because I'm absolutely with you, I'll sit here and complain, but if. Any of the late night shows would like to offer me a job, I'll be a staff writer.
Yeah,
without absolutely. Question. Seth Meyers, I'm
sure.
There.
Sure.
Anything I can do to work with the Seth Meyers staff, because he has some of the most brilliant staff writers of any show. Then absolutely. If it's a sitcom. Yeah, but if it's, a show like that, bring it on.
This reminds me, weaving back to the theater concept, this reminds me of, like, why I write for theater. I write for theater because I love it so much and simultaneously kind of hate bad theater so much. I hate the theater that I don't like. I really don't like it, so I want to write my own.
Right.
And I think that there's something to that as an artist, right? You have to have – every artist, you have to be a critic as well because you have to know what you're making and why you're making an original contribution.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And so let me ask you this. How do you feel about the Tonys?
Oh, I'm going to steer clear of that. I mean, it's just another award ceremony. Okay. And again, I just think tonally, it's just, I mean, that you want to talk about a group of nepotistic insiders in and around New York City. It's just, that's what that is. It is what it is. I mean, I remember watching the Tonys as a kid though, and going, wow, one day that just looks so cool. You know, they're accepting one another. But of course, you know, there's nobody meaner and nobody bitchier than somebody in the New York theater who get it. If you're on the bad side of somebody in New York theater, you don't exist to them.
You don't need brutal. To add the word New York.
Right.
Just say theater, Kevin, because
there's that fake theater. I'm going to hug you. I'm going to kiss you on the cheek. I'm going to say, oh, you were so good. And then in the back, everybody's just like this.
Oh yeah.
I've been guilty of it in the past. I try not to be that way. But these are people who trade in fakery. That's what the business is. The business is show business, and it does not stop when the curtain goes down.
Yeah.
So you just got to remember that.
Well, I love this. I met some people recently at a socially distanced birthday party. Everyone was outside in the backyard and we were all like, we all had our lawn chairs set up appropriately distanced. And,
oh, boy.
And so they were like, oh, and, you know, I hate to ask you, what do you do? But you know, what's your thing? And I was like, oh, I'm a stand-up comic. And they were like, oh really? I was like, yeah, I lie for, you know, my living. That's what I, and they're like, well, I wouldn't call it lying so much. And I'm like, but that's what I do.
You get up every night, and comedians, for the most part, you have something that you've been saying for 6 months and you're pretending that you just came up with it that very day.
Yeah.
That's how comedy works.
Yep. And the more you make it seem like it's just, you're up there having a conversation, and you know, I was like, yes, regardless of how autobiographical a lot of my material is, I still take that moment and then I turn it into a caricature of itself. So it's funny.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a lot of truth in it? Yes, because there's a lot of truth in good comedy.
Yeah.
Now there's absurdist comedy, which is great too. And if you can pull it off, great. But yeah. There's a lot of truth coming out in comedy.
Yeah.
But you have to lie to make it funny. And you have to, you know,
sell it.
Yeah. And it's I love just, they're like, well, I wouldn't really call that lying. I'm like, no, I would. And I said, I was kind of snippy. I was like, so have you done stand up for a while then? And they were like, well, no, we're not stand ups. I said, then let me just tell you that stand up comics on stage are liars. We're That's liars.
You know what this reminds me of is David Mamet has this great point of whatever you think about Mamet and his politics. His theoretical writing on theater is very interesting. It's worth a look. He's a great propagandist and obviously a great dramatist. But he makes a point in one of his books. He says, you know, something to the effect of, you know, the reason the audience has to pay for a performance for it to mean anything is because they are paying you for the permission to suspend their disbelief. That coin has to trade hands. It has to, they have to give something away. Everybody knows you don't value what you don't pay for. And Gurdjieff said that. People don't value what you don't pay for. I love that. So theater is still that funky place where you pay $20, you pay $200 if it's Hamilton, whatever it is, to suspend your disbelief for an evening, and you can be 80 years old, and that's what you're in for. And I love that, and I believe it is truly at the center of what makes us human. I think if it goes away, we will have lost our humanity. I think that the reason that the Greeks we also associate theater with democracy. Yes. They had their democracy, they had their theater, and theater was mandatory. If you were a citizen in Greece, you had to go on and put all the sort of gender politics, all that garbage aside, just fundamentally understand that they had to go to the theater to be a citizen. You had to engage with this collective catharsis. You had to share this sort of experience. And I just think that's so central to our humanity. I would even ask people, if you're listening to Moderation, do me a favor and put your phone away when you listen to it. If you can manage, that would be awesome. If not, that's fine. Double screen if you want, but if we're gonna put a theater production on, the phones go away. What other places are like that? Maybe a funeral home, maybe a church. So it's still this unusual,
supposed
sacred,
to be comedy clubs.
Yeah, comedy clubs. Put your damn phone away, man. I love stand up comedy so much. I'll come and see you sometime. My favorite right now has got to be Tim Dillon. Tim Dillon is he's making a mess right now. And
yes,
I love
he
it.
Is.
Yeah,
he is fantastic at flipping the middle finger to everybody. And I like a comic who is good at that.
Yeah.
Because not every comedian is good at flipping the middle finger to everybody. Because because Tim Dillon will look at he'll look at one side and be like, "You know what? Screw you." And the other side goes, "Yay!" And then he'll do it, be like, no, you're not exempt either. Let me give you some over here. And then the other side goes, yay. And he's like, you guys need to understand, I hate everyone equally. I love, Tim Dillon is...
He's a genius. Dan Carney is kind of on tour with him right now, too. And I think we're mutuals on Twitter. So shout out to Dan Carney getting to open for him. What an experience. I mean, that's the kind of thing that 20 years from now, Carney will be talking about that. And I'm sure he'll, on his own terms, become a great comedian. I'm sure he's already great. I haven't seen them. I had tickets to go see them, but of course it didn't... it didn't happen this year, but I just think he's brilliant. His new interview is with Little Zan. He has little Zan on his. I can't wait to watch that.
That's great.
You know, Little Zan is a big fan, and Tim Dillon is a an old school theater guy. I think he used to do theater. He was like a child actor or whatever. He roasted me. I bought one of his shirts. I bought the Life in the Big City T-shirt that he was selling with the cigarettes and the whatever and the bag of booze. And I took a picture of myself. And he came back and said, "This guy gets called in every time there's a murder in his hometown." And if you don't understand comedy and like what an honor it is to be roasted by a comedian you love, then you have no place in a comedy club.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's fantastic. Yeah. So I don't know if we specifically said your love is theater. I think we said it earlier on in the show.
Yeah.
And I'm with you in that I have a love-hate relationship with theater.
Yeah.
When it's good, man, when it's good theater, whether I'm performing in it or just watching, God, is it, you know, one of the, this sounds so, I always fear saying this because it sounds pretentious, but it's not. I have a genuine love for Shakespeare, and yeah. I discovered Shakespeare through an English teacher in junior high. And I went and to the public library and checked out the annotated Shakespeares because there was dust collecting on them in my little town of 4,200 people.
Yeah.
And so it got to the point where the librarians almost just gave them to me.
Yeah.
Because I was the only one that ever touched them. And I have my wife and I met doing Much Ado About Nothing. Yeah. That's not true. It wasn't Much Ado About Nothing. It was, why am I blanking on, it's a great show.
Twelfth Night?
We did do Twelfth Night. No, this
Midsummer?
Charles the Wrestler.
As You Like It.
As You Like It. Thank you. I'm going to be cutting that part because...
No, right. Yeah, As You Like It by Beckett.
Yeah, but yes. you ever Beckett's seen Whatever You Like by Dr. Samuel Beckett from Quantum Leap?
There's a podcast called Beckett's Babies that I'm going on. That's a playwriting podcast, so I think that's got nice. That's in my mind. So look out for that. But yeah, you were saying, so you met on As You Like It.
Yeah, and you know, we did Twelfth Night together. We've actually done several shows. She's one of those people that she's a brilliant stage manager, but she's also a really good actress. But she won't admit that she's a good actress. She prefers being
Midwestern.
Behind. Yeah. Well, yeah. And she is a brilliant stage manager. And you know, having done theater, that a stage manager can make or break a production.
Absolutely. As important as the director.
Yeah. But yeah. I say all that to say, I have been a part of really, really bad theater. And I've also been a part of some amazing shows. But I want to share with you real quick.
Yeah, yeah.
The worst show I ever did.
Okay. All right, I'm going to sit back here.
It was my freshman year. Any chance
high school or college?
College.
College.
College. I was a theater major. Oof. And, yeah. Because,
oh.
Boy, do I. I looked at all the majors and I was like, you know what? I hate eating and supporting myself.
And look at you now.
Yeah, and here I am, down here in the danger dungeon. So I was in a student-produced play that was an experimental play by an independent playwright, and the show was called Lepus. And I'm giving this way too much credit. It was... And it was a... the main character was, I believe, a writer who was having delusions of a giant rabbit, not unlike
Holy Grail.
No, Clarence.
Oh, Clarence.
Not Clarence. What was it with Jimmy Stewart?
Oh, I don't know.
It was a play that turned into they made into a movie with Jimmy Stewart about the giant invisible rabbit.
Harvey.
Clarence was the angel. But yes, Harvey. My character was a Harvey-like character. I was in a giant bunny costume with a full suit, the paws, the feet, buck teeth, full makeup.
You realize we're coming full circle here to the furry business.
Yes. Oh, I know. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. A long story short, it was terribly written. We all were doing our best with this script. I kept begging my family, please don't come. They're like, we're coming. I was like, please don't.
Now, oh, that's the worst.
Earlier on, I had done a production of Sexual Perversity in Chicago.
Oh, yeah, Mamet.
And great. I was Bernie. And
yeah, that's a fun play.
Oh, yeah. And Bernie's such a fun character, too. And I was like, come to that one. I say some pretty horrible things, but this is a good play, and that no one came to that except for one of my aunts. I then do this show, and I'm like, please don't. Please. And they're like, we're bringing grandma. I was like, you really, please don't bring grandma. Because at the end of the play, and I'm not giving anything away because I've tried to find it. I've tried to find a copy of it just to show everyone.
Oh, boy.
At the end of the play, my Harvey, me, rapes the man to death.
Oh, no!
And now I say rapes.
Right.
It was consensual.
Oh.
But it wasn't loving.
So
it,
here's what I'm getting. I'm getting, day man, master of the night man.
Yes.
greatest episode of television of all time, Sonny.
Yes.
Day man cometh.
Yes.
Greatest episode of all time.
So I say that to say that I know what bad theater is, mm-hmm. which what is has given me my love of good theater.
Yeah.
So I want to know what is the worst, if you're willing to tell me, what's the worst thing you've ever.
That I've ever been a part of.
Let's do that because, you know.
God, that is tough because I really don't want to throw anybody under the bus because it was kind of in a quasi professional. It wasn't like in a student setting. Let me rack my brain. I don't want to throw anybody under the bus in such a public manner. Let me think about it. I've seen some. I'm trying to think of something that I've done. Why? You know what I can do? I've thought of one. So because it's about me. And the same way that you, yeah. It's tough as a playwright because if you have to watch your own show completely go off the rails
yeah.
when there are critics in the audience and things from real papers and stuff because one of the actors was in an automobile accident and was on some medication and everything, that is a hell of a night in the theater. That is – so you're sitting back and you're watching. So – and it's tough. Theater is hard. That's the other thing that I think is lost. It's very, very, very hard, and it takes a certain. There, you'll see a production, and you'll see a bad night of the production, and 3 nights later, it'll be the greatest mm-hmm. thing that you've ever seen. That's why we go because there is that risk. That's part of the fun of it. But I was in a production of The Good Doctor, which is the play that what's his name? Neil Simon wrote. And I played the lead. They kind of split the part of the lead out a little bit because this was like in North Minneapolis, a community theater. This is right when I decided I'm going to get into theater. I really wish I had done theater and now I'm going to do it. You know, it was this great little community theater. And I went to a class. I went to an adult acting class and we did the lottery and you know, I had my brother came and I was, I'm in the theater now. And then we did a play and we did this Neil Simon play and it's The Good Doctor. It's just a bunch of sketches and vignettes and it's all pulled from Russian literature, right? So it's Chekhov and this and that. And I'm sure I was awful. I'm a mediocre actor at best. But I did it, and I would encourage any young playwright, and even any old playwright, if you haven't acted in a while, you need to go do it. Even if it's reading stage directions, you have to be in the theater, you have to be around people reading, you have to be around actors, because you cannot write for performance if you don't know what performance is and if you've never done it. Full stop. There may be exceptions out there, but they're few and far between, and I just encourage everybody to go into the theater. Being a playwright is not a literary practice. It's nice to see when something gets published and people can enjoy it on the page, but that's not what it is. So you have to go in and do it. So anyway, I acted and there was one night where I can't even remember what the scene was because it was so, and I think my family was in the audience that night and we were doing it in like a little community center in North Minneapolis, the middle of nowhere, you know, and I think I had a cold and I was just feeling awful and I corpsed in the middle of a scene. To the point where I was just like gulping for air, couldn't remember my lines, went into that hidey hole that you go into. If you've never corpsed on stage in front of 50 people,
I have.
Wow. And my actor buddy, the guy who was my scene partner there, kind of pulled me out of it and we got on with it. But my God, I still managed to get some laughs somehow. It was weird. But it's like a dream. It's like a dream state. I don't even remember. You know, what happened during the moment. It probably lasted all of 20 seconds, but I'll be haunted by it for the rest of my life.
I did it during one of the, one of the nights of As You Like It, as Charles the Wrestler, you come in and you are Captain Exposition. You kind of get everyone caught up. And I had been doing this monologue for weeks in rehearsal, nailing it, had done it opening night. The second night, I get fed my line. Is there any, what news of the court? And I stood there and it just was like a desert wasteland. Just a tumbleweed went through my brain.
Every second in that moment.
Yeah.
Is like an eternity. It's dead air on a podcast.
Yes.
Just, and then you're in it and it's you and there's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to hide.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I was still wearing, because as Charles, we were doing it kind of modernish, and so I was in a full black suit, black shirt, black sunglasses, and so the audience couldn't see the panic behind the sunglasses.
Uh-huh.
And fortunately, right. My scene partner was also a friend of mine, and so yeah. He was counting in his head. He's like, I'm going to give him X amount of seconds, and then I'll start feeding.
Deliver the line.
Yep. And right before, like, he was starting to talk, I laughed menacingly and put my hand up as if to say, no, let me speak. And it just came back. I was so lucky.
God.
But yeah, it's just, and you get the flop sweat.
Yep.
And it's just, you're like, I want to please vanish me from existence. Let me ask this though. We're talking about theater. When did you discover, what were you, like a kid that you're like, theater is rad and I want to do this?
Oh, that's so interesting. I got taken to the theater in my small town, Bismarck, Mandan, North Dakota, a few times. And then I was kind of an awkward teenager, like a lot of artists, you know, kind of a weird kid. And, I was backstage at some point, briefly. And then kind of went away from it. And then in college, I just sort of tried to blast through college. Was writing horrible novels, not knowing what I was doing. And then it kind of dawned on me, I'm really social. I'm very outgoing, probably over-demonstrative, pretty out there at times. And, I've toned down with age, but I mean, still. And I realized, I love to write dialogue. And then it all kind of clicked, and I said, I was in my early 20s, and I'm like, I kind of regret not going to the theater. And I'm like, why am I having regrets? I'm in my early 20s. You know, surely there has to be something I can do. And I started to write short plays, and I went into the theater. I went into this little community acting class, in North Minneapolis. It's called the Workhouse Theater. Shout out to all those people if they're still out there. I'm sure they are. And it was just, I got a little bit of an education, and I learned about Sam Shepard and Chekhov and Beckett and et cetera, et cetera. And, I really enjoyed Shakespeare in high school. I would rather read that than a lot of the books that we were being assigned. And so I was reading Hamlet in class. I remember getting in trouble for that. But I mean, just realizing, I'm an outgoing guy. I'm social. I like to, I like to write dialogue, and then it kind of all, and of course, as a teenager, we were the role-playing nerds, kind of that, and that's all just very theatrical. Yeah, very nerdy. It's very high level. Do you have your guns hidden away? Are your guns hidden away? Because I'm going to say it. It was very high level nerd Kabbalah. I don't want you to be triggered. Yeah, there he goes. Manchurian candidate. I finally got Larry to go. Yeah.
Man, and I had plans today.
Where's Trump right now? Where are Pence? Where's Pence right now?
Let's not say that.
No, I just want to know, because I mean, who knows? Yeah, no, I'm kidding. That's pretty funny, though. So we got that out of the way. But yeah, no, and so it was like a case of, I want to do that. And then I wrote a short play. It was some sort of an Iraq war themed sniper thing, very pretentious and whatever. But I got called, I was like a semifinalist or a finalist for some award or whatever. And they give those things away to everybody. but at the same time, it was like, that's interesting. I knocked on a door here and something came back, and there wasn't really anything else in my life, where there was any door kind of open to sort of like civic life. I wasn't going to go be a journalist. I wasn't, I had a degree in history and philosophy, and I certainly wasn't going to go be an historian. I wasn't going to go be a philosopher. you know, whatever that means. And I'm going to say one other thing. There was a fellow in at university, a professor. I don't recall his name, but he was teaching one of these big English seminars at Minnesota where I went. Go Gophers. And we had a bad one last night against Michigan, but that's okay. He taught Fences in class, the great play Fences. And of course, August Wilson lived in St. Paul, and the Playwright Center is a big force here in the Twin Cities and nationally. Shout out to the Playwright Center. And there was just this sort of like awareness that like there's a thing going on here. There's a theater scene here. There's something that I can kind of engage with. And I loved Fences. I thought, wow, you can do that with a play. Incredible. And I kind of squirreled that away in my brain. And I've been chasing that feeling ever since with a new play every year.
That's fantastic. That's probably the best answer that I get it. When I was six, I got to see a high school production of Evita. Mm. And they said the word slut. And I was like, you can say words like that on stage in public? And then I watched two people kiss. And I was like, you get to do that? And at 6 years old, and then we went and saw You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. And I was like, I'm in. I want to be Snoopy.
Yeah.
Snoopy's.
Yeah.
You know, I like the idea. I pretend all the time. If you can just play pretend for a living, this would be amazing. So I get this, those aha moments, especially when you're younger. Being a big role-playing nerd.
Yeah.
And I say nerd and all love.
Oh, sure. The nerds won. I mean, we've won.
Oh, for sure.
Big time.
Yeah.
Run things.
Yeah. Video game development, all media. It's just
it's all nerds.
So, take that, guys.
Take that.
Take that, guys that played football.
I'm going to go cry in the corner.
No. Go cry in the shower, because then you can't tell when the water hits.
It hides it.
That's what I like to do.
That's good.
All right, Kevin, I have kept you on here for a long time, and I could talk to you for probably 4 hours.
Larry, I had a really good time.
Would you come back on with me?
Absolutely, and I want you to come back on to get this sometime, and this is just a real joy, and I earnestly appreciate everything you said about moderation, and I have to do that thing.
Please do.
That everybody does, but I am... It would not exist if it weren't for the talented people at Spooky Action, in addition to a number of friends and colleagues in New York and in London who volunteer their time to something that is purely speculative. And we've all been to these readings where you read a play and you know, you think in your mind, this is never going anywhere. You don't know. It's always a risk. You're burning your time. All we have on this earth is time. And so I'm very deeply grateful to them, in addition to lots of other people. And I have to say that it's no one person writes or even makes a play ever.
Right.
Even a one man show. There's always, it's a community effort. So I just got to say that. And of course I want everybody to go to moderationplay.com. It's going to be out on Tuesday. You can binge listen to it, and hopefully the play will have a good long life. There's a mailing list there. I think you can connect with me there, and I love feedback. I love hearing from people. I'm very active on Twitter. That's where Larry and I met. So I just invite everybody to get in there and let me know what you think of the play.
That's awesome. You did all my job for me at the end. It's like you host a podcast or something.
Yeah. And get over to getthispodcast.com. Yeah. No, that's so great, Larry. And I love this format for this show. That was fun. And,
I'm glad you had a good time, and I that's all we want to do with this show is have a good time and also showcase rad people. And so welcome to the Rad Dude Club.
Oh man, it's so good to be in the Rad Dude Club.
Because when you think rad dude, the first three letters that come to your mind are NPNR.
My favorite joke from Mystery Science Theater 3000 of all time, and I love those guys. Is very Minnesota energy, MST3K, and theater nerds too, right? My favorite joke was, I think Tom Servo says it, and there's some voiceover happening, and he goes, and now for information on the sedatives used by our DJs here at NPR, something like that. So I'm glad I didn't contribute to NPR voice. There's a very particular tone and style there, isn't there?
There is, and I do try really hard to not do it, because I'll be honest, the first few interviews I did, I was very, well, I'm on NPR, and I have to speak in a certain way. And now I'm like, they brought me onto this network because they were just like, hey, here's a loudmouth comic that's probably going to do something that may be questionable. Let's have him do it anyway.
Yeah. All right, man. That's awesome. I'm glad. That's cool. But, you know, yeah, shout out to everybody at NPR. Well, I'm going to go on some alternative podcasts, too. So this is my, this might be my out if I go on some of the more naughty podcasts. This
will absolutely. Be my,
I was on NPR, too. Come on, guys.
Yeah, come on. Come on, guys. I'm king of the nerds.
that was the get this episode, right?
Yeah, king of the rednecks was mine.
King of the rednecks. Yeah. Okay, well, king of the nerds, man. Yeah. Doing, again, I'm not going to say it a fourth time, but you know, we got think. Larry, this is awesome. So,
Thanks again for being on.
Let's do it again, buddy.
Absolutely. All right, guys. Thanks for joining me and Kevin on this episode of Convince Me.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org. You can also find and follow us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram and Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter.